I'm actually not going to read a whole lot of these chapters. We're going to go through chapter 23 and 24. The reason why we're not going to read a whole lot is because chapters 23 and 24 are really long, and very little happens. Like, I don't know why the author chose to expound these. Like the destruction of Sodom is two verses, but Abraham buying a cave is a chapter. First, I don't know what the author is thinking here, but it's just it's a long chapter. I mean, part of me understands why he did it. The reason is because this tract of land that Abraham buys is the only tract of land he ends up owning throughout his entire life. So that's pretty important, I guess. But I don't think it needs to be this long. But anyway, chapter 23, this is what happens. Sarah dies, and Abraham buys her a tomb. And basically, he's kind of going on the same tune that he's been playing since Genesis 15, where some of his neighbors try to be generous to him. They're like, hey, dude, like, we'll just give you a cave to bury your wife. And he goes, no, I need to pay for it. Because remember in Genesis 15 and 14 why he said he wouldn't take money from anyone? You guys remember? In Genesis 14 and 15, he says, I'm not going to take money from anyone lest someone say that I made Abraham rich. So for Abraham, his life is to reflect the glory of God, that God alone is what's blessing him and prospering him. So he didn't want to receive any charity from anyone to prove that God is the one who is blessing him. Do you guys get that? So he makes sure to buy this cave from this guy. Now, just two things I want to pull out from this chapter before we move on to chapter 24. The first thing comes in verse 2. It says, Sarah died in Kirjath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. This is something that I've witnessed in being a Christian for a relatively long time. I've been a Christian my whole life. And something that I've learned very quickly is that Christians don't do well with death. We really don't. The people who have loved ones who die don't do well with death, and the people who know someone who has someone who's a loved one who dies don't do well. I'll ask you guys both questions. The first question is I've noticed that if someone in the church has a friend who has a loved one who's died, they'll usually come up to that person and say things like, hey man, they're in a better place. Or dude, you know, God's got a plan. Or, you know, like, dude, it's all right. You know, they're in heaven or something like that. They'll say some cliched Christian kind of thing. It doesn't help. It doesn't help anyone. Like anyone who's, and this is the weirdest thing to me about this, is that death is something that's universal. Everybody has somebody who's died in their life. And if you don't have someone who's died in your life, just wait. Right? Because death comes to everybody. Death comes to everybody. Either you're going to die and leave the people you love alone, or they're going to die and leave you alone. There's really no other option unless you and your entire family and group of friends get on a plane together and you all go down. You know, that's the only way out of that. But primarily, death impacts every single person. And every single person knows that hearing after someone dies, someone coming up to you and saying, like, dude, they're in a better place, is not what you want to hear. You know, let me ask you, why don't you want to hear that? That's huge, right? Why did God have to take them away from me? They're in a good place with me, okay? That doesn't give me any consolation. Why else? I'll give you the simplest answer, okay? Logical answers rarely work for people who are in pain. Okay, if one of you, like, tripped on the basketball court today and fractured your femur, which is, I heard, the most painful injury one can sustain, even over childbirth, ladies, so... But anyway, if one of you tripped and fractured your femur on the basketball court, if I came up to you and gave you the logical answer of, hey man, that happened because you tripped and twisted your ankle in that way, but don't worry, I'm going to take you to the doctor and he's going to reset the bone and you're going to be A-okay. Is that true? It's true, but is that what he needs right now? No, okay? Emotional pain hurts deeper than physical pain. Anyone who's been in emotional pain knows that's true. Right, physical pain hurts, but at the end of the day, I could deal with physical pain because I understand it. Right? It makes sense to me. In fact, a lot of people who cut themselves, you know why they cut themselves? This is not everybody, but a lot of people who cut themselves, they cut themselves because they have deep emotional pain and they don't know how to express it properly. And so they give themselves physical pain to try to process their emotional pain. Do you guys understand their reasoning? Okay. That's why. They know that there's something deeply wrong with them, but they just can't figure out what to do with it. Physical pain is actually kind of simple to deal with, right? If I stub my toe, or if, you know, any of the, you know, when I sprain my back, or any of the other horrible injuries I've sustained during my lifetime, as much as they sucked, at the end of the day, I knew, first of all, it's going to get better. I knew that. And secondly, I knew whenever a pain happened, I was like, I know what this is my back acting up. Emotional pain is not like that. Emotional pain, first of all, you act out in weird ways. Some of the weirdest things sets off emotional pain when you're in the midst of depression or grief, right? You know, sometimes you'll be doing totally fine. You wake up, you're like, man, everything's great. And then someone gives you coffee and you're like, dude, I used to drink coffee with my mom. And you'll just like start crying. And they're like, what happened? And you're just, I don't know. You know, and you're just like freaking out. Like, emotional pain is weird. It like acts up in the weirdest ways. And beyond that, with emotional pain, with physical pain, once again, like I said, you always know in your head it's going to get better. With emotional pain, you don't feel like it is, do you? You feel like, dude, I think this is getting worse. I feel like this is getting more intense. So do you see why logical answers don't help? And this is just a general rule. If it doesn't help with the physical pain, don't apply it to emotional pain. Okay, just think that way. That's why Christians are kind of bad at that. Now, the second thing that I said is Christians are bad at dealing with pain. So when someone dies, we're bad at dealing with it. And usually when people give us the cliches, we feel kind of inclined to say the same cliches back. Like, dude, she's in a better place. I know. You know, I know, I know. The Lord's got it. Lord's good all the time. You know, I got this. You know what? Why do we say stuff like that? Why can't I just go in front of my buddy and just be like, hey, man, you know what? The truth is I want to commit suicide. I'm hurting so bad. You know, and I don't believe God is good. And I think he's terrible. And this sucks. And my life sucks. Why don't we say things like that? It's pride, right? Now, when you say things like that, do you feel like a good Christian? Like, no, good Christians don't say that. Good Christians don't say that. That's what bad Christians say, all right? Good Christians say, the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I like how a lot of Christians quote that verse, but they don't quote the rest of Job. They don't, they're like, after someone dies, they're not like, oh, that I was a stillborn fetus, you know, like Job, which is in the book of Job, by the way. Yeah, no one quotes that passage. Everyone just quotes, oh, the Lord giveth. Lord, they don't quote Job's wife, curse God and die, right? They don't quote that, you know, but it's in the Bible. They don't quote Jeremiah where he says, oh, that my head were made of waters, that I would never cease weeping. Right? They don't quote that passage. They don't quote Lamentations where he says, the Lord has shot my liver with arrows. You know, like they don't quote that one. Are those people godly? Yeah, they're godly. So why don't we feel comfortable saying what they said? You guys understand that? Why don't we feel comfortable saying that? What's wrong with us? You guys understand why that's weird? And this is any amount of physical pain. Any amount of physical pain that happens in our life. You know, like let's take something a little less. You know, if I lost, let's say I got fired today. I would feel inclined to tell you guys, like, hey, I got fired, but God's got a plan in all this. You know, like, dude, that's not what I believe in the moment. In the moment, I'm freaking out. I'm like, what am I going to do for a living? You know, this is terrible. You know, I'm not thinking that way. Why am I lying? You know, or if one of you guys are in a relationship and it breaks up and it's really terrible, you'd be like, well, I know God's got something better for me. You know, you don't believe that. Why are you saying it? Does that make sense? Like, why is that coming out of your mouth if it's not true? You wouldn't say that with a physical injury, would you? You know, I'm like visiting you in the hospital. You got a broken leg and you're like, yeah, it's okay. I got another leg. You know, it's not a big deal. I know that this is going to heal, so I mean, I'm good. You know, like, dude, no one says that in physical injuries. You know what they say? I visited a lot of people in hospitals, and no one has talked about their physical injuries to me that way, ever. Not even Christians. They'll say, dude, this sucks. The road to recovery is going to be long and difficult and hard, but I know I have to do it. They'll say things like that to me. And I'm like, dude, that's good. I'm glad you understand this. But the thing is, why can't we be that realistic with emotional pain? Why can't we just say that? Like, go in front of us and be like, dude, you know what? I'm in a lot of pain. And I understand that, like, the road to recovery in this is going to be long. It's not going to be over tomorrow. And that also goes into emotional pain not being physical, where we as Christians, like, let's say one day I do have a serious conversation with one of you. You know, let's say your dad dies and I sit down with you and I'm like, hey, dude, like, how you doing? And you're like, dude, this sucks. Life's terrible. And we have this deep conversation about God and you're like, dude, thanks, bro. We pray. The next day I expect you to be better. I come back, how you doing? You're like, I'm still bad. Really? But we had a long conversation yesterday. And we prayed. You know, like, dude, don't you trust God? You know, like, why are you crying? You know, and it, like, it freaks us out, you know. Emotional pain is like physical. It takes time to heal. It doesn't just go away. It's a process of healing. You're going to go through, like I said, good times and bad times. And the idea that we could be fake with one another and just say, like, oh, no, I'm good, is crap. One of the things that we need to learn how to do properly in Christianity is learn how to properly mourn. Abraham came from a culture. I loved their culture, man. I would love if this was our culture. When someone died in your family, you know what you would do? You would tear your clothes. You'd wear a burlap sack for at least a month. For at least a month. And you would spread ash on your head. And you'd walk around like that. And so when you're walking around, people weren't like, hey, are you okay? You know, like they would look at the burlap sack. They would see the ash on your head and they'd be like, oh, dude, he's mourning. You guys understand that? And so people would treat you like that. They would understand, oh, like Peter's mourning. He's hurting. So they would wear clothes. Why were they wearing burlap? Because it's itchy. It's uncomfortable. What are they showing? Like, dude, I'm in pain. Put ash on their head. What's ash come from? Fire. Dude, something destroyed my life. All right, have sympathy on me. Have compassion on me. To put it another way, it was inviting people to weep with you. You guys understand that? And that's what you need when you're hurting. You don't need logical answers. You don't need someone to be like, hey, dude, like, I understand. No, you don't. You just be there, right? Just hang out with me. Just weep with me. And yeah, sometimes, like I said, people who are mourning are going to need logical answers at some point. But more than that, more than logical answers, they're going to just need your presence. They're going to need you to just hang out with them. So because we're so bad as Christians, this is definitely a verse for us to just read through and be like, dude, do you consider it okay to mourn? Is that okay with you? Or do you feel guilty about that? Guilty about telling people, like, dude, I'm hurting. I need help. I need someone to help me out. That's something that we all need to learn how to do. Do you guys have any questions about that? No. Second thing I want to bring up is the cave. The cave is interesting. Now, back in the day, they used to bury people in kind of an interesting way. They would buy caves. In Abraham's day, they would usually just lay the cave. They would, like, dig out a hole in the cave, and they would put the body there. Later on, they developed something called an ossuary. I don't know if you guys have ever heard that term. An ossuary was a bone box. So what they would do is they would wrap you in linen and spices, almost like mummify you, except without taking out the brain and all that weird stuff. They would, like, almost mummify you, and they would let you kind of decompose for, like, 6 months. And then when you were done, they would dump your bones inside of this ossuary, this big stone box, and they would close it up, and they would put it in this cave. Right? And it would all be in this cave. Now, here's a question, and it's one that no atheist could really answer. Now, when someone's dead, they're dead. That body's useless, right? Why do we bury bodies? Why do we put tombstones? Why do we put people in caves? What's in us as human beings that would do that? Do animals do that? They eat them, right? Dude, it's dead. Dude, don't let his flesh go to waste. You know, that's what they're thinking. You know, like, dude, I'm hungry, man. Oh, man, I miss Jerry so much. You know, you're eating his leg, you know, like, dude, hey, man, I don't want it to go to waste. Not one, not, man. You know, I'm like, that's an animal thing. Why is it with humans that we do this? Showing respect. But why is that respectful? Now, let me flip it this way. Why do Christians do it? Resurrection. What do we believe is going to happen to the dead bodies? They're going to be raised, right? They're going to be raised. Those bodies are going to be raised. The corruption is going to put on incorruption. This mortality will put on immortality. This is all 1 Corinthians 15, right? Just as Jesus was raised, right? When they went to the tomb was empty, right? That was his body that came up. It wasn't like he got a new body and, like, Jesus' body was still in the tomb. Yeah, dude, oh, that's crazy. No, the body that was buried was raised. We have this promise that God has given us that one day this body that's decaying and falling apart is going to be raised in an immortal form, essentially. So you see why we put tombstones in front of people and stuff like that, why we put them in caves and why we do that? It is to honor them. You are correct. But it's more as a promise. We know that, man, these people are going to be raised. We know that this person is coming back. It's a sign of hopefulness. Do you guys understand that? And when Abraham's buying this cave, he sees it as a sign of hopefulness for that, but he also sees it as a sign of hopefulness for something else. In Genesis 15, God told Abraham very specifically, he said, your kids are going into slavery for 400 years, and you're going to come back. Abraham buying this piece of land, and so it was a cave, but it was also land around it, it was him trusting God. I know that this will be the dwelling place of my generations forever. You guys get that? It was a hopefulness. The reason why we as Christians, why funerals, by the way, are so important, why we do funerals, if you ever wondered, like, why do you do funerals? Why do you do memorials? Why not just, you know, the dude's dead, just let it go. You know, the reason why we do it is to show respect to the dead person and to remember his goodness, but it's also a form of hope. One of the things that you and I are going to need, death is terrible. It's a terrible thing. There's no way around it. It's going to hurt. But what we have as Christians, we have hope. Paul in 1 Thessalonians 4, he says, we mourn, but we mourn not as those who have no hope. Right, so if my wife died today, it would be terrible. But there would be a hope in me that would enable me to get past it. Does that make sense? It may take months, it may take years for me to get past it. But this hope that one day she's not dead, she's with God, and one day that body that I'm looking at will be raised again, and I will be raised with her. That hope enables me to function and to keep living and to keep moving and to not forget that person. See, if I'm just living from a secular point of view, what benefit is there to remember someone who's dead? Does it help me? It just brings back the pain. It makes things worse, right? That person's not coming back. It just reminds me of the fact that I'm never going to see them again. Do you guys see the absolute necessity for hope? So when you're going to a funeral, just always remember that. Why am I going to this funeral? It's for hope. It's to remember hope. It's to allow that hope to seep into my heart. Because when I've gone to memorials, there's a part of them that's kind of funny to me, because in a really sick way. But you know, there's a part that's really ironically funny. I've been to quite a few funerals, you know, and I've seen a lot of people being buried. And the interesting thing about funerals is I've never seen anyone talk about someone's failures before. Never seen anyone get up in a funeral and be like, yeah, I remember this one time where this dude and me got prostitutes, like, in L.A., dude, and it was crazy, and everyone's like, whoa, like, that's, I know he's a flawed human being, and that's okay, you know, you don't see a son get up and be like, dude, I remember this one time my dad punched me in the face so hard that I lost a baby tooth, and it was crazy, man, but, you know, but he was a good guy, you know, like, they don't say that, they only say good things. Does that make sense? They only say good things about the person. And so for us as a culture, we think that that's what a memorial is supposed to be. We just remember the good things. Now, the problem with that is we call it nostalgia. You guys know what that is? Nostalgia is this powerful emotional thing that happens to us where we remember all the good things, but we forget all the bad things of a certain thing. That's why I don't recommend too strongly for you guys to watch movies that you loved when you were 6 years old. Because they live great in this little nostalgia part of your mind where you're like, man, I remember watching, you know, Barney, and you're like, dude, that was so fun with my friends, and that was so cool. If you go watch it again, you'll be like, dude, I was a retard. Like, why did I like this? You know, like, you'll be angry with yourself because nostalgia, right, it coats over the bad and it just preserves the good. Nostalgia is not actually a good thing because if it makes you unrealistic in your relationships with people. Where you feel like relationships should be like that. It should just all be about, you know, just surface level hypocrisy. Which is, again, what encourages us to be fake with our Christian brothers and sisters when we're actually hurting. Now, I'm not at all suggesting that at funerals people should go up and talk crap about the deceased. What I'm saying is that when you're thinking about people, like the purpose of the funeral is not just to create nostalgia so you can get over the death. The purpose of the funeral is to remember that, like, hey, this person's a flawed person. They're a mess. And we had our issues, we had our problems, but you know what? That person's no longer flawed. And there's hope. There's hope in what Christ has done, and to remember that. Even if you're at a funeral of someone who didn't even know God, did you know that there's hope? Even if you're at a funeral of someone who like denied God their entire life, there's hope. You know what that hope is? You don't know what happened, right? When someone dies, there's a lot of stuff that happens between someone living and dying. You know, no matter what kind of death it is, no matter how sudden it is, you don't know what happened. You know, maybe they did give their life to God right before they died. You just didn't know about it. Right, so what we do in funerals is we remember the hope, and the hope is in Christ, not in that person. Like, if there's any hope that this person's in heaven, it's by the grace and the faithfulness of God. Right, I say that at righteous people's funerals and wicked people's funerals, because the only righteousness that person had was his faithfulness in God. Right, so that's the hope that we have in any funeral that we go to. You know, and I've been at rough ones, don't get me wrong. I've been at funerals of little kids. I've been at funerals. One of the roughest ones, other than the little kid one, was a daughter died at the age of like 35, I think. She passed away, and then the mom committed suicide the next month, and that was rough, you know, because it was the same people in the room with the mom, and it was, you could tell that memorial was just so heavy and so hard, you know. But the thing that we needed to remember in that moment is what? Hope. Hope. Where's our hope? We need to talk about God. You know, it's not about just talking about someone's good points, but we need to talk about God and why we should trust that this person's in secure hands. You know, that's really important. So those are the two things that we could really grab out of that chapter, is the idea of hope and the idea of mourning after a loss. Do you guys have any questions about that? No. Okay. Cool. And like I said, that idea of hope exists in every form of emotional pain. Right? If I lost a job, if I got fired today, what should I hope in? Right. Well, I mean, let me put it this way. Who's my provider anyway? God, right? So if I got fired from this job, is he going to let me die? You know, like no, right? Yeah, you blew it. You lost that job. You know, you're done, right? So if I get fired today and I put my faith in myself, I'm going to probably commit suicide. Like, dude, I'm just going to screw up the next job. You know, like, what hope do I have? You know, but if I put my hope in God, I'm like, dude, I know that God can help me. I know he could work in me. I know he could provide for me. I know he could take care of me. No matter what tragedy you go in through, hoping in God is the only way you're going to be able to withstand the storm. Right? Hebrews 6 says this, "This hope we have is an anchor for our souls, both sure and steadfast, that pierces through to the other side of the veil." It's the hope in God that allows us to get through whatever storm we might go into. Right? But mourning is important. Not just before people, but learning how to mourn before God is really important. Learning how to talk to God honestly. Like Job did, like Jeremiah did, like David did in a lot of the Psalms, being willing to go before God and say, like, God, you know what? I really do feel like you've abandoned me. I really do feel like this is your fault. I really like saying things like that and not worrying about God, like, smacking you in the face, right? But knowing that, like, dude, God is good. Like, he loves me, and I want to invite him in to comfort me in this time, right? So don't expect answers from God. But when you invite God into your pain, you're giving him the opportunity to comfort you. Jesus said in Matthew 5, "Blessed are those who mourn, for you're going to be comforted." That's what he said. You can't comfort those who don't mourn, though. Right? If you're being fake before God, how is he going to comfort you? Does that make sense? Right? If I'm just being fake in front of you guys, like, no, I'm doing great. I'm doing awesome. You know, you're like, dude, you need anything? No, I don't need anything. I'm great. You can't comfort me. The only way you can comfort me is if I'm honest. Right? God's the same way. Blessed are those who mourn, for you're going to be comforted. Anyway. Chapter 24, once again, I'm not going to read it because it's not important. No, I'm just kidding. What happens in chapter 24 is basically Abraham, he's getting old, and he wants to make sure that his son Isaac is taken care of. At this point, Isaac's around 40. He's around 40 years old, and Abraham's about to die, and he's like, dude, Isaac's not married. Dude's bachelor forever. I need to help him out, right? So he goes to his most trusted servant, and he tells him, like, hey, I don't want him to marry the Canaanite women because they're really immoral. They're idolatrous. They do all these types of horrible pagan practices. Go to my family. Go to my family that I left back in Haran, right? Abraham, remember, he migrated from his family and he moved into Israel. So go back to my family in Haran, find him a wife from them, and then bring her back here. So he sends him out, and this guy, he goes, and he loads up 10 camels worth of treasure, which is pretty radical. That's like a U-Haul. You know, like he's like, so he sends him out with like a U-Haul full of treasure, and he goes out there, and he's like, he's chilling by this well, and it's at sunset where all the women came and draw their water, and he's like, you know what, God, if you're in this, he's like, let the next woman who comes out, let her not only give me water, but water my 10 camels. Let's put that in modern vernacular. It would be like this. It would be like, once again, I'm driving a tractor trailer. I'm driving like a semi through the wilderness. And I'm like, dude, let the next person I see not only, you know, give me food, but also let them fill up my semi with gas. You know, like that's a lot of money, right? To fill something like that up. To fill up 10 camels, you know how much water that is? Like plus they're camels. They drink a lot, dude, and there's 10 of them. And you know how they got water? By putting a bucket down and dragging it up, right? Triceps, all triceps, right? And you get it up, and then you bring it in and you water. I mean, it would have to be like at least like 30 trips to the stinking well. That would be a pretty jacked girl to be able to do that. And so he says, like, dude, let that be the girl. And Rebecca comes, and he sees her, and she's really pretty, and she's like, hey, I'll do it for you. And she grabs it, and she does it. And he's like, this is the girl. And he gives her some jewelry. He just throws jewelry at her. He's like, man, like, take me to your family. And she's like, what is going on? And so, like, she brings it to her family. And her family is a bunch of greedy people. We meet this guy named Laban. Keep that name in mind. He's going to come in handy later on in the story. But he's a con artist. He's a bit of a jerk. And he sees his sister come in, and he sees her jewelry. He sees her bling. And he's like, whoa. That dude's awesome. Yeah, I want to get in close with that guy. You know, so he like starts smoozing. He starts smoozing Abraham's servant, Eliezer. He's like, hey, Eliezer, how you doing, bro? It's good that you came here, man. And he's like starting to get money from him. And it's going great. And Rebecca agrees. She says, hey, I'll go back with you. I'll meet your master. And so he takes her. And just you ladies, think about this. Back in the day when you got married, you would be taken from your family. And you'd probably never see him again. Right, so that was the decision she had to make. Is in that moment she had to make the decision of, I'm going to leave my family, I'm never going to see him again, and I'm going to go marry this guy that I've never met before. Right, and she makes the decision. She says, I'm going to do it. So he takes her over there. She sees Isaac. He's hanging out in the field. Says he's meditating. You know, which is kind of cool. It's like hanging in the fields, just meditating, thinking about God. She sees him. He sees her. He runs over, and it says they get married. And it says, man, he loved her deeply. We'll talk about that later. And it says that she comforted him. Now, a couple things that I want to bring out. In the Bible, there's no such thing as dating. You guys are aware of this, right? No such thing as dating in the Bible. That's why I'm always, like, perturbed when people in the Christian faith try to give people rules for dating. I'm like, dude, you know there's no dating in the Bible, right? It doesn't exist. They lived in a culture of betrothal, arranged marriages. That's how it worked. So for me to, like, give someone a law and be like, dude, only side hugs when you're dating, there's no dating in the Bible. You're not going to find that verse in the Bible because there's no dating in the Bible, dude. You could make that as a general rule of like, hey, like these are the reasons why that would be a good idea, but you can't give it to someone as a commandment. You can't say, do no making out before you get married. You can't say that. It's not in the Bible. It's no dating. Do you guys get that? There's no dating in the Bible. It's just not in there. All right, there are reasonings that I could give to not do that, but there's no law. There's no commandment that would say that in the Bible. I can't read, you know, Leviticus 24, where it says, thou shalt not make out before you're wed. You know, like, that doesn't exist. It's not there. All right, thou shalt only, you know, do cheek kisses or, you know, side hugs or high fives before the wedding day. You know, it's not in there. You're not going to find it. So that's, I just wanted to get that out of the way, just right off the bat. Now, here's the reasonings, right? Why as Christians do we say things like that, though? What's our reasoning behind it? That's right. So what I understand as a man is I understand that, you know what, deep down in my heart when I was dating my now wife, I understood I want to protect her purity. I knew that. I knew I wanted to protect her purity. I knew I didn't want to have sex with her before we got married. There's many reasons of why. I'm not going to get into all of them. But the main reason is because simply I wanted to protect her relationship with God. And I've seen so many times inside the Christian church how guilt and shame over going too far in a dating relationship will just impact someone for the rest of their life. And I didn't want that for her. And I wanted her to know that I was committed to her. You know, how do you show a woman that you're really committed to her betterment? By resisting your most basic urges. Does that make sense? And saying like, dude, I'm putting your needs above my urges. And I wanted that. I wanted that more than anything. And you ladies, that's a great thing to look for in a guy, that he would put your needs above his urges. If he doesn't do that, if he puts his urges above your needs, it's not a good guy. It's not a good guy. Right? You want someone who's going to put your needs above his urges. And the thing is that I knew that I wanted to, but you know what else I understood about my heart? I knew that I was wicked. I knew I was wicked. I knew I am wicked. And that if I was in the right situation, no matter how much I valued my wife's needs, I would make the wrong decision. Does that make sense? There are so many things that I don't want to do all the time and I end up doing them, right? I don't want to lie, but in certain situations I lie. I don't want to, right? I don't want to be angry at people and yell at people, but in certain situations I do. I don't want to view pornography, but in certain situations I'm really sorely tempted to do it, and sometimes I fall. Does that make sense? So because of my understanding, right, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak, because of my understanding of my own heart, I set up boundaries in our relationship for me. Does that make sense? But where Christians get it off is where they look at that as a sense of holiness. Now, here's the grand question. Why did I need those boundaries in our relationship? Why did I set them up? Was it because I'm an awesome guy? No, it's because I'm what? Because I'm weak and wicked. So I can't possibly look at the things that I did with my wife and be like, dude, I'm so holy. We only side-hugged. Yeah, we're such a holy couple. No, we're so unholy that we had to do that lest we fall. Does that make sense? Like that was our problem. But that's okay. Does that make sense? That's okay. You just need to be honest with where you're at. Be honest with where you're at. Where you fall into problems is when you become so proud and think like, I wouldn't do that. And then you do it. Right? Be very honest with where you're at as a human being. And that's how you make your different boundaries for dating. You make your own boundaries based on wisdom from people around you and from understanding of your own heart. Someone who's not dealing with their sinful nature, though, and doesn't know the pull of their sinful nature, will never be able to make proper boundaries. Does that make sense? If I'm not dealing with my sinful nature, I'll be like, no, I don't struggle with stuff. Yeah, I don't want to smoke, so I don't smoke. Easy, you know. Someone like that, dude, you're so naive. You are so naive that even if God, you know, God willing, you do make it to marriage and you don't have sex, you know why you didn't have sex? It's because of what? It's because of God and His glory and a care for your spouse. Why'd you do it? Because of pride. I wanted God to bless my marriage, so, you know, I sucked it up and I was a man and I didn't have sex with my wife. You know, that's why. You know, like, it's just a proud, arrogant, boastful thing. And it's so gross when people do that. Like, it's just like, it's like in my heart when I hear people say things like that, I'm like, that's so nasty. You know, so vile. I would have rather you had sex. You know, like, I would have rather you had sex before you got married. Because this proud, arrogant, like, boastful thing is not going to help you out. And then what they do is they import their impurity on other people. And they say, like, we didn't do it. Why did you do it? You know, and they judge people. And it's just gross. You know, God's not happy with it. All right, so those are just things to think about when it comes to dating. Now, here's another thing. It really does say that when he saw her, it says that she was beautiful. It says she was attractive. The Bible doesn't steer away from people being attractive. Do you guys know that? It says that a lot of people are attractive. It says a lot of people are attractive. And you know, ironically, you know who the only person in the Bible that's said to have not been very attractive? Jesus. Isn't that weird? Everyone in the Bible, like, dude, David was attractive, Rebecca's attractive, Leah's attractive, Sarah's attractive, Joseph's attractive. All these people are attractive. Jesus, he had no form that he was attractive. And we're like, yeah, Jesus wasn't attractive. Yeah, I guess he wasn't. You know, I guess he wasn't a very good looking guy. Yeah, he's just a normal guy, you know, but I'm not even going to talk about that right now. But it's just really interesting to me that the Bible's like that. But the Bible doesn't say anything's wrong with attractiveness. You guys understand that? There's nothing wrong with that. And you know who's seeing her as attractive? Who's seeing her as attractive? Is it Isaac? No, it's who? It's Eliezer. Does Eliezer want to have sex with her? No. Probably. He's a guy, so... Yeah, probably, you know. No, right? Here's something that our culture just doesn't get. And it comes from, I wish I could go deeper into this. I don't have time. It comes from a misunderstanding of love. In Hebrew, understanding, you know how many words they had for love? At least six. They actually had more than that, but they had six main ones. And here's how they define love. They had ahav, which is the general beautiful form of love, which, by the way, in the Bible, as of the end of chapter 24, you know how many times the Bible's used the word ahav? Twice. Okay, we'll talk about that, because it's actually really important when the Bible uses ahav. But anyway, what they said is ahav is the general word, and within ahav is every piece of love. Love is complete in ahav. Do you guys get that? Now, the other words for love just talk about one aspect of ahav. Just one. So let me give you one word that ahav includes. It's the word daud. It's the word to mean boil over. So it's a word for passion. You guys understand that? And passion, intimacy. That's the word daud is. Now, remember, that's just one aspect of love. But in our culture, we think of daud as love. When I feel that passion and burning for someone, I'm like, dude, love. I love that person. I love them. Well, you partially love them. You have a piece of love. But that one aspect is just, it's not all of love. And because we define passion as love, we are so immature when it comes to love. First of all, because we define that as love, and we're so immature in that way, we think of attraction as being synonymous with love. You guys get that? So I'm with my wife, and I see a girl, and I'm like, oh, she's attractive. And what that's interpreted as is lust. Does that make sense? Everyone in the room would interpret that as, oh, Peter lusts after that girl. He wants to be with her intimately. He has a doubt for her. Is that necessarily true? No. But because we're so immature, we actually think that way. Right? Attractiveness is just attractiveness. That's it. You can be attracted to any number of things in your life. That doesn't mean that you're lusting after it. Right? To see someone as being attractive is just recognizing what they are. What are you going to say? No, they're ugly, right? You know, you look at women, you're like, no, that chick's ugly, you know, because I'm not attracted to them. Right? Being attracted is not synonymous with love. Now, here's the thing. Once again, if you understand your own heart, you do understand when lust happens, though. Does that make sense? You do understand when lust happens. If you never evaluate your own heart, you'll never be able to separate the difference between lust and attraction. You're always going to link them together. And you're either going to be that person who's like, dude, I don't lust after anyone. In reality, you're lusting after everyone. Or you're going to be the person who's like, dude, I lust after everyone. And really, you're not lusting after anyone. You know, like, dude, you'll err on one side or the other. You need to understand the difference between attraction and lust. You guys get that? You need to understand there's a wide difference between attraction and lust. Attraction is an important part of my marriage. But that's not all of my marriage. It's not like we stood up on the altar and Emma's like, why are you marrying me? I'm because I'm attracted to you. The end. You know, like that's it. So you better remain attractive or else we're done. You know, or else this is over, right? There are so many layers to our love for one another. There's so many reasons of why we're attracted to one another beyond the physical. And the physical is important, though. Does that make sense? It's not like, and once again, Christians err on this side too, where they're like, dude, attraction is not important at all. Well, it kind of is. You know, I mean, it would be really, I mean, how many of you guys would like to marry someone who thought of you as ugly? But they're like, but you got a great personality. Oh, okay. You think I agree, but you're not attracted to me physically at all. Okay, but that's cool though, that you like my personality. That's great. You know, that's lame. No one wants that. Now, one thing I will say about attraction before we move on to anything else. Attraction is usually dictated by the culture. What is attractive? Attractive qualities is dictated by the culture. Okay? Different cultures, if you go around the world, what is attractive to different cultures is way different. Right? You go into our culture, right? Being tan is an attractive character quality in our culture. You go to most other cultures, that's a very ugly characteristic. Because you know who's tan in other cultures? Poor people, right? Rich people are pale because they don't have to be outside. Does that make sense? So they look at tan and they're like, dude, poor, unattractive, ugly. Right? Our culture, we're like, dude, we like men to be, you know, in shape physically, and that's how we like them. And other cultures, they like men to be out of shape. Because once again, if you're in shape, you're probably what? Poor, because you have to work outside. If you're out of shape, you're rich. Dude, you must have enough money to just sit on your butt and order people to do stuff for you, right? So that's attractive in their culture, right? And actually the same thing with women, right? We tend to like slender frames in our culture. Other cultures like bigger frames because bigger frames denotes more ability for childbirth, right? So attraction is totally dictated. If you think that like, man, no, I'm my own person. I find out what's attractive and what's not. No, you're not. Dude, you're a total puppet on a string. You are totally dancing to the tune of what TV and magazines have been telling you your entire life. So you don't know what attractive is. And the thing is that if you just think of that as your framework for attraction, you're never going to be able to be attracted to anyone. Because you know what you're going to find whenever you get into a relationship with anyone? Doesn't matter how good looking they are. Every single person has physical flaws. Do you guys get that? Every person has physical flaws. And every person has personality flaws. And if you can't balance those and you can't realize that, dude, no, I'm attracted to this person because I love them, right? That love comes and understanding of attraction comes and they work together. What I say, attraction is just one part of love, right? But when all aspects of love are working together, then attraction plays a really good part and it helps you. And the other parts of love increase attraction because you're understanding them and you're working through them. Do you guys get that? And understanding that it's not just like, oh, my man, you know, who could be, you know, and a lot of us, if we have different body types from what our culture says is attractive, we think of ourselves as unattractive. Maybe that's not true, though. Does that make sense? Maybe you need to start thinking differently. And maybe your culture is wrong. You ever thought about that? And maybe, just maybe, you don't want to date someone who gets their cues on attraction from the culture alone. Because that's really shallow. Does that make sense? Like, who really wants to be like that for the rest of their life? Where it's just like, dude, if she doesn't look like a supermodel from Victoria's Secret, ugly, you know, like, dude, don't care. You know, that's so incredibly shallow, it's not even funny. All right, again, I don't have time to get into this, but there's so many nuances to this and so many things. Even racial attraction comes from this, right? What we consider as more attractive races and less attractive races comes from what we see on TV, right? Because you look on TV, even watching shows that quote-unquote have minorities in it, the minorities are still the minorities, right? They're still only like one family. They're like the token Mexican family in the show. And you're like, oh, that's cool, you know. But like everyone else is white. And you're like, okay. So when you're looking at TV and you're looking at movies and you're just being inundated with attractive people who are white, 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 it starts filtering through your brain and you start seeing attraction through races. Do you guys understand that? That's bad. That's bad. You don't want to be a puppet on a string. You don't want to be dancing to the culture's tune. You want to understand attraction in a deeper way. Now, the next thing I want to point out about her attractiveness is it wasn't just an attractiveness of her looks. Remember what test he gave her? What did he say? She has to feed me and who else? The camels. Right? Now, what does that show about her as a person? She's a caring, compassionate, empathetic person. Right? She doesn't know this guy, but she's willing to give a total stranger at least an hour of work just because. Do you think that's an attractive character quality someone has? Right? So he's not just he's not just looking at physical attraction, but he's looking at her personality. What kind of person is she? Is she empathetic? Is she compassionate? Also remember, where is he right now? Why didn't he go to the women of Canaan? Because they're wicked. They were idolatrous. Does that make sense? So here's the thing. When you're thinking about, you know, potential spouses, dating relationships, everything like that, when we're thinking about attraction, okay, it's all right to have non-negotiables. Just figure out what those non-negotiables are. It's not shallow to have non-negotiables. It's not wrong for a Christian guy to say, you know what, I don't really want to be with a girl who's intensely shallow. Is that a wrong thing? Or for you ladies, be like, I don't want to be with a guy who has no ambition in life and just wants to be a pro gamer. Right, playing on Xbox Live and try to be, you know, sponsored or whatever. You know, I don't want to be with that. It's okay to have that type of a non-negotiable in your head, of like there's a different personality trait that I'm looking for. It's okay to have that, and it's also okay to have. And the most important non-negotiable that you could ever have is spiritual. Where are they with God? That's the most important non-negotiable that you could possibly have in your relationship with someone. Okay, it's not wrong to do that. Now, where we get off. Where our culture gets off is, I've heard this so many times that it just makes me sick to my stomach whenever I hear someone say this. I don't know if they're the one. I hate it. It's something about when someone says that to me, it just infuriates the living daylights out of me. Because here's what someone's actually saying. If they really meant it this way, I'd be totally cool with it. But no one means it this way. This is the way that would actually be biblical. I know that God is sovereign and nothing happens outside of his will, and I know that he already knows the person I'm going to be with for the rest of my life, and I'm going to submit to his will. That would be the theologically good way to say, I'm looking for the one. But what do people actually mean when they say, I'm looking for the one? It means my. Here's the thing, all right? They don't just have like a couple non-negotiables. They actually have a model that they're looking for. They're like, they must be like this and this and this and this. Dark hair, not blonde hair. Blonde hair, not dark hair. They have to be this race. They have to be this thing. And you're thinking through it. You're like, okay, do they meet all the checklists? They're not the one. They're not the one. They can't be the one, right? It's not the one. That is selfish. You guys understand that? Beyond that, they usually mean the one is they're looking for an emotion as well. Well, I dated him a couple times, but I don't know if he's the one. I'm not feeling it. You know, I don't know if he's the one. All right. If your definition of the one is that unbelievably shallow that it can rise and fall by your emotional state, your emotions could be impacted by what food you eat. Your emotions could be, I mean, do you really want to base a relationship with someone on your emotions? That is the worst place to ground your relationship. That's why I have so many, I've had Christians come up to me who are married and they're like, I don't know if it was the one that God had for me. Well, bro, you're married. It's the one God has for you. God hates divorce. What part of that do you not get? It's the one, she's the one for you, all right? Like it or not, this is God's sovereign plan for your life. You're in it, deal with it, okay? Don't give me this garbage. Okay, but because they're like, I don't know, I'm not feeling it anymore. And it used to be, it just makes me sick. It really does. It's just putting Christian language on secular thought. That's it. Of you're looking for an emotion, you're looking for a feeling. You're not actually looking for love. Great example of this, and by the way, I love this show, so I don't want to disparage it too much. The Office. You watch The Office. In the first couple seasons, Pam is dating Roy, and he's a total jerk. And the whole season, you're like, dude, how is she dating this guy? He's such a tool. And like, but the whole time, you're like, you know that who is she meant to be with? Jim. So you totally overlook the fact, that she basically cheated on Roy. And you're like, no, but it's okay that they did that. Because Jim was the one. He was the one they were meant to be with. So it totally excuses the fact that she was being flirtatious with a dude who wasn't her fiancé. It excuses the fact that she made out with a guy that wasn't her fiancé and then called off the wedding that same week. It's like everything they do, you just excuse because you're like, no, they were meant to be. They were meant to be, man. So it's Jim Halpert. So cool. And anyway, I love the show. But when I watch that, that message is so abhorrent to me, though. Because I'm like, dude, does that make it okay? If I'm engaged to a girl and she cheats on me because I'm not so-called, quote-unquote, the one, does that excuse her actions? No. All right. Okay. I wasn't the one. All right. Okay. For a while, I thought I was, but I was confused. So thanks for putting that straight. Go ahead and cheat on me. We're good, right? You know, we're totally cool, right? So this idea, it's totally emotionally based and it's totally fleshly based. It's selfish. And if you live like that, once again, you'll never learn how to love anyone. Because you're always going to find flaws with the other person. And you either do the good Christian thing and just put up with him and not say anything, or you're going to do the bad Christian thing and say, he's not the one, you're going to leave. Both are wrong. We learn in Christianity to, by grace, date people and to be married to people in spite of their faults, not because of their successes. But we always maintain the non-negotiables. It's okay to have non-negotiables. Just remember, don't stretch that too far. Like, yeah, you know, girl being, you know, this weight, that's a non-negotiable. Okay, that's not a good non-negotiable. Okay, a guy making 50K a year, that's a non-negotiable. Okay, is that really a good non-negotiable, though? Does that make sense? Right, a guy having this degree, that's non-negotiable. That's not a good non-negotiable. Okay, there's the things that actually matter and there's the things that don't. And when you see attraction starting happen, it's okay to talk and dialogue about it with someone. But once you start talking about and dialoguing about attraction, just know that you're walking the line of dating. Even if you haven't dated someone yet, you are walking the line of dating. And the number one way to just totally devastate someone is to talk to someone about your attraction for them and then be like, oh, but I don't think we should date. That's a great way to devastate them and just be a jerk, right? So when you're talking to someone about attraction, do it understanding that one of the words for love, by the way, in Hebrew, can't go through all of them. one of the words for love, one of the most important ones, is commitment. It's the word chasak, and it literally means to link something together permanently. Okay, you can't have love that's going to develop and grow and be awesome unless there's commitment within it. That needs to be there. Now, the reason why I said the wording of ahav is actually really important, the first time ahav is used is in Genesis 22, and is described the love of Abraham to his son regarding the sacrifice. So it reflects what? The Father and the Son in the crucifixion of Jesus. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever should believe in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. Second time it's used is to describe the Son's love, right? Isaac is the son of promise. The Son's love for who? His wife. Isn't that cool? So if I want to understand biblical love, what is it? The love of the Father to the Son in the sacrifice, and then the love of the Son to the bride, who's us, right? That's the way we understand it. So it's really cool when we study that and understand love. And the final thing is that her love for him actually comforted him during his mother's death. Once again, when we're suffering and we're mourning, the thing we need more than anything else is just we need the comfort of love. We need to know that someone's there for us and they care about us. That's what we need more than anything. That's going to help us out a lot. So there's a lot more I could go into with that, but we're out of time. So let's pray, and you guys are good. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for this study. I pray that we would learn from it, that you would teach us how to be people that walk in love and not in lust. And God, we pray that we would learn from you and not from our culture. And in your name, amen.